You are tuned in to the NTD Broadcast Network presentation of Off Camera with Sam Jones. The best conversations happen off camera.
Hello and welcome to another edition of Off Camera. I'm your host, Sam Jones, and in this episode, I sit down with actor Laura Dern. Any 7-year-old who inhales 19 ice cream cones in a row for her first movie appearance, arranges a clandestine meeting with an agent at age 11, and inflates her age by an improbable 8 years to audition for the role of a 19-year-old, really wants to be an actress. Maybe Laura Dern never really had a choice anyway. The daughter of acclaimed actors Bruce Dern and Diane Ladd was assured of her destiny by Martin Scorsese, who saw her future in the fact that she didn't throw up the aforementioned ice cream cones. He was right. Dern gives us complicated personalities whose often baffling behavior we somehow understand due to the firm and uncompromising grip she keeps on their humanity. It's a rare ability to find in any actor. It's a crucial ability for an actor whose carefully selected projects started and largely remain with directors like David Lynch, Alexander Payne, and Martha Coolidge, whose films aren't widely populated by America's sweetheart-type characters. In this interview, she discusses what she's endeavored to bring to some of her early roles in films, like Foxes, Smooth Talk, Wild at Heart, and Blue Velvet, and those films' effect on her as a young actress growing into womanhood on camera. To understand her approach is to understand how the best in their craft can suck us into their characters' psyches without ever realizing we're there. Dern also touches on some of her enviable mentors and getting closure on the cancellation of her brilliant HBO series, Enlightened. Obviously and deeply in love with every aspect of filmmaking, Dern is as fascinating to talk to as she is to watch. She's the friend you'd want to stay up with all night for the most fun and interesting conversation. Off Camera apologizes in advance. This interview will leave you wanting more. So pull up a chair and listen in. Well, Laura, thanks for coming.
I'm so happy to be here.
Well, I don't know if your publicist told you, but I'm going to focus most of the interview on one of your lesser-known films.
Perfect.
Grizzly 2.
I love it.
Okay.
I'm so excited.
How did you prepare for... No.
You know, by the way, I'm still waiting to see that movie, so that's a good movie to focus on.
I think the world is, yeah. It's funny, though, when you start doing research, what you come up with.
Oh, dude, right? I'm impressed already. Actually, no one had ever seen it, which was, you know, thrilling to myself, George Clooney and Charlie Sheen. But I saw George and was like, I don't think anybody's ever seen this, thank God. And then I think 2 weeks later or something, I did an interview with Peter Travers in New York. And they showed a clip from Grizzly 2. But it must be the only existing clip.
Well,
hopefully no
on
one will get crazy. And
that's right. It's over
I haven't now. Seen it. Oh, God.
Well, the good thing is it's like so dark and poorly like uploaded that you can barely tell what's going on. The audio is good, though. So I want to start just by talking about how there's one thing I noticed, one through line in your acting seems to be that you infuse your characters with a sense of sincerity and a sense of interest. There's a sense of interest that comes through in your character about the world, always. And I wonder if you have thoughts about how important it is for an actor to be more of a participant and an observer and interested in the outside world.
You know, with no judgment, I'll say I have enjoyed and been thrilled by careers of very different types of actors, actors who trained forever, actors who've never taken acting lessons, you know, people who've come from so many different walks of life. And there are wonderful actors who aren't particularly politicized or who necessarily use their voice in the world. But there is something to be said for the choices that an actor makes who is deeply invested in what we're saying in the world, however that comes out. You and I were talking about George Clooney, and George is an example of that. You know, whether it's as a filmmaker or as an actor, he's deeply invested in, you know, in this amount of time that I have, to use my creative voice. What do I want to investigate? What do I want to explore? And that's just super exciting to me. When I was 7 years old, my mom was doing Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore, which was being directed by Martin Scorsese, and he was the first person who sort of jokingly encouraged me to be an actor. I had been an extra in the film, and you know, there's a story that he put me, you know, sort of prominently in this shot where I'm eating an ice cream cone, and then he shot it 19 times. So I had to eat 19 ice cream cones. And he took me over to my mom and said, this girl just ate 19 ice creams and didn't get sick. She's got to be an actress. But I remember kind of going, uh-uh. And then watching him, you know, for 9 weeks direct actors so beautifully. It was such a collaboration. There was so much improvisation and respect for the process. And it was so exciting to me. And when I was in my teens, he and I had a phone conversation, and he was going to produce a film for a writer who was going to direct their first feature. And he gave me the most encouraging comment, which speaks to this question, which was, he said, you know, Laura, what's really cool is you're really building a body of work like a filmmaker does. He said, don't stop doing that, because that's what you should feel like at the end of your career, that you've used acting as a filmmaker. I think that's super exciting when we can all consider the whole body of work and not just the gig,
right,
in terms of what we want to say or what interests us.
Looking at just your list of films, at a certain point you have to assume that there's a design to it. It's not just a series of independent choices, and you got lucky to develop this body of work that does say something to that very philosophy. But what age did you kind of become aware, like, okay, I am going to think in terms of the big picture rather than film to film?
You know, I definitely far more so in the last 15 years. But I will say that as a kid, I just got so unbelievably lucky. You know, I was raised by very committed actors. I was raised around, like I said, Scorsese and Hal Ashby, and fell in love with films, you know, that these extraordinary filmmakers were making in the 70s that my parents were part of. And I know I had a taste. But just because you have a certain taste doesn't mean those people are going to pick you when you first audition. And I remember simultaneously screen testing for a very popular Brat Pack film at the same time that I screen test for Mask, and I got the Bogdanovich movie. Then same thing, a Brat Pack option became a possibility in my teen years, and Smooth Talk, which was a film that was a huge turning point for me in terms of my career. And I started to see how filmmakers who had real vision, luckily for me, were picking me. So I got to learn about acting through people who were very independently minded. And I think, you know, that shaped my career far more than me making the choice. It was just how I got chosen. And obviously then, you know, at 17, David Lynch wanted to work with me, which was a miracle because it's been such a huge part of my life and my career. So, you know, but I think then once I entered maybe my mid-20s or something, I started to really carefully choose the filmmakers that I was excited to work with or the kinds of characters I wanted to play.
I think that's interesting that even at that age, and maybe from your parents, seeing their choices and their friends and who came over, you really did have a very inside look at independent and counterculture filmmaking. When you think about Hal Ashby and what David Lynch was doing early in his career, and if that was just the norm at your house,
yeah.
Was that from an early age just the way filmmaking was to you?
You know, it's funny, your questions are so beautiful because they, you know, get my brain thinking in a different way. So I've never really talked about this, but I have to say, yes, it did. And obviously, and I've talked about how the filmmakers got me thinking differently, but just the way you phrased it about, you know, being around my house and what I was seeing, how that got me thinking differently. And I think about the fact that my parents divorced and, you know, in my, you know, let's say from 9 to 14, my mom spent a lot of time getting together with her tribe of women who were other single parents, actresses, raising kids in the industry who were like-minded and good friends of hers. And it's pretty incredible how lucky I was, because my godmother was Shelley Winters, and I spent a great deal of time with Shelley, and my mom was very dear friends with Maureen Stapleton, Colleen Dewhurst. You know, I was around Ellen Burstyn. I was around very specific actors.
Yeah.
They were character actors. In their minds, their job was no different than any man, nor were they clocking protecting beauty or age. It was about the role, and it was about the commitment to the role. And so their careers were very much a filmmaking body of work. And that was really beautiful. As I was starting to study acting and becoming an actor, and my first teacher, the first person I watched teach, was Lee Strasberg, and, you know, listening to the way he taught was a huge influence on me. Susan Strasberg, his daughter, was one of my mom's best friends, and I was around a great deal. Peggy Fury, who I was around a great deal and became a teacher. All these women were just massive influences on me.
Wow. And did it happen so young in terms of the Scorsese experience and getting roles young that you never had to stop and say, what do I want to be when I grow up? Like, did you just know? Or was it something where at one point you sat down with your mom and said, I want to do this for real. I want to be serious.
Both. I mean, I knew probably at about 8 that's what I was going to do. And then I went to her at 9 very seriously and said I really wanted to do it. So she told me I had to study for 2 years and I had to give up play dates, weekends, going to camp. I had to go to an acting school to sort of see what my level of commitment was, which was a very smart choice on her part. And it wasn't a sacrifice. I was in love with it. It's what I wanted to do. So, but ultimately I loved riding horses at the time and I really wanted a horse. And we even went to a place in Topanga and they were leasing horses. I was gonna have my own horse and it was a big dream. And that was the moment when it was about 10 and a half that she said, you have a choice to make. You're either gonna give all your time to this horse and make this your passion and really train, or you're gonna do it with acting. And I chose acting ultimately, which was painful.
Wow.
But really good for me. And I told my parents when I was 11 that I really wanted to start acting, which they thought was a horrible idea. So I did what any manipulative, smart 11-year-old would do. I went to an actor named Bo Hopkins, who was a friend of my mom's, and said, Bo, who's your agent? Will you introduce me? Met her at his house and asked her if I could come audition for her. Auditioned for her with, like, you know, a monologue I'd learned at camp or something. And she said, I'll send you on an audition and see what the response is.
And this was all outside your parents?
All outside. I mean, she ultimately called my mom and said, she really wants to do this. Can I send her on an audition? And my mom said, yeah, but honey, you know, this is the life of hard knocks. Get ready. And it was for the director, Adrian Lyne, and he auditioned me for one of the 3 or 4 leads in the film. They're 18, 19. I was 11, lied and said I was 14 because I was 5'10 at the time. So he believed that I was older and then liked the idea of me for the part. And I screen test with Jodie Foster at Paramount, this like massive, fancy screen test. I was so nervous.
This is your first audition.
My first audition became a screen test, which Jody still remembers with great laughter. I was such a wreck. And then he called my mom. He's like, it's funny. I mean, I know she's a little young. I know she's turning 15. Mom was like, she is. He said, yeah, but really the character should be 19 and she's got a real edge and real damage to her. So I'd like to give her another role, a smaller role in the film for this 14-year-old. I was like, you know, she is 11. So it was shocking to all of us. And I lost the role to Cherie Curry.
You're kidding.
Who's so awesome. So it was a great and very cool tribute. And that movie was called Foxes. And I got to do 2 weeks on the film doing, I think, 4 scenes in the movie. And that was sort of my first professional gig. But I loved it. And I loved everything. I loved a tutor on set. I loved, you know, talking to everybody. I loved the crew. I liked learning what everybody did. I was obsessed. But, you know, it was all I ever really knew. So I was super comfortable on a set. And cameras are comfortable to me,
right.
As weird as that sounds. I mean, I just sort of, that part was never odd.
Well, before that, when you were younger, say from whatever, 4 to 10, did you kind of grow up on movie sets anyway, just being around your mom?
Yeah, always on my mom's sets. And my dad, a little less. But he did the Hitchcock film Family Plot the same year my mom was doing Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore. And that was shot in California, in LA. So I spent a lot of time on that set. Black Sunday, Coming Home, things that were done in LA, I would spend some time on. But
right.
But with my mom, I was always with her. And then, you know, I thank God I had my grandmother who really raised me while my parents worked. But with a single parent, you know, you just kind of went, and there was nobody really there to watch you or nannies on set. And it
right.
was not really set up for women then like it is now. We're very lucky actresses. So I spent, I think, a lot of time on set watching.
Wow. Yeah, it takes a village, you know, a village of filmmakers. And I mean, it's a great environment for a kid in some ways, I think, because by the time you put together an experienced crew.
Yeah.
It really is the best people, like people who really are good at their jobs. And I find people that work on film sets in general to be some of the salt of the earth best people in the world, because they wouldn't last if they weren't, you
yeah.
know. And so I think in some ways that's what a great opportunity to grow up in that environment. There's a respect for filmmaking, and it shows in everyone that's on a set.
My dad was a great teacher to me too, because he is an actor who goes through hair and makeup, and then he gets a chair or a camera box, any Apple box, and he sits on set and he watches and he tells stories, because to him, filmmaking is this team effort. And, you know, actresses have less luxury often with touch-ups and hair and makeup changeovers and all that kind of stuff. But I really grew to love being there and being on set as much as possible. Because you really get inside what each department is thinking about the next scene. And all our ideas are what invest in the character we're creating together. It's not just, you know, I have my part, you have your part. And the minute you're on a movie like that, mm-hmm. it's just mm-hmm. never the same. You know, you want the relationship to an operator, which is why often my closest relationships have been DPs that also operate, because it's the two of us, it feels like, in that quiet world. And but even, you know, for the operator, regardless of whether they're the cinematographer as well, when they pull their eye away from an eyepiece and look at me, I know whether or not I was honest, and if it, I need to go again. I feel you can instinctually feel like if it was truthful or not. So it's such an intimate relationship. And there are so many more intimate relationships for different reasons that teach you so many things.
I read once that an actor said, what you really want a director to be is the ultimate audience member who's right there with you and knows if you're giving the performance. So does that DP relationship sometimes end up that way?
I think so, completely. You know, very specifically, you know, there are people who have been that for me in my life. You know, like directors who I've worked with a number of times, or a couple of DPs where I've worked with them several times. And so you get a real intimate relationship within the work, and there's nothing like it. But directors that I've worked with again and again, or are family members to me, or you just have that thing, you just have a deep connection. Mm-hmm. And I've been lucky to be asked back by directors who feel like that to me. So I can just look in their eyes and know, or in the case of David Lynch, he'll go, cut, well, tidbit, you'll have them bolting for the fire exits, going again. That's his big line to let me know I suck. So some people say it more subtly. I loved also working with Clint Eastwood on a film. And Clint was so funny. And he was my co-star, so he was directing himself from here. And he'd ask Jack Green, who was our DP, how it looked. And then on his close-up, you know, he'd finish, he'd say the lines, and instead of saying cut, he goes, that's enough of that crap. So there are some people who just call it out. But others, you know, you just look in their eye and you know they need something different.
Right, right. When I shot Harrison Ford, I didn't know, but he has kind of a ritual right before he starts shooting. He comes out of the trailer and came right up to me and said, okay, let's shoot this piece of shit. And he just walked past me. And I thought, oh God, he's in a terrible mood. And as it turns out, that's what he
always
says at the beginning of every morning.
I like that.
Yeah.
I know, that's a good thing to get a warning about, I guess.
Right, right. Well, you know, it makes me wonder what you know, obviously you've worked with some directors several times, but you're still, you'll still walk into a situation with new directors, especially on your television show.
Yeah.
And I wonder at this stage in your life versus maybe when you were younger, what are you ultimately looking for from a director?
I think the number one thing is deep respect for the character.
Okay.
I think if they're as in love with the character as I am, we're about to have a party.
So you're both talking about a third person at that point.
Yeah.
And you can break that down.
Yeah.
So it's nothing about your performance, it's what would that character do?
Yeah, because if they're in judgment of her, then they're going to be in judgment of me or choices I make. And the great gift that I've been given in the parts that I've been able to play, they're deeply complicated and they're deeply flawed. And with that can come a great deal of judgment. So I won't be in judgment of her because I can't play a part if I am. But if the director is filming from that sentiment, then I'll never be as bold because he's looking for choices that are gonna make her more palatable for an audience.
Right.
That's not my homie. I like people who are thinking about no one and in that moment are considering what's the most truthful thing that this person would do. And it may not be pretty and it may not be kind and it may be embarrassing, but it's the truth. And from that breeds compassion, humor, damage, and all the wonderful things that I think make those of us who like those characters a thrilled audience.
And realism, authenticity.
Yeah, but you know, I can only experience what I'm feeling. I'm not seeing it. So I need the director to be in the same place I am. And then in the editing room, he can judge all he wants.
Sure.
And say, whoa, that was way too far. Or my God, given the scene now, the way I've cut it before, we have to have some empathy here for her. So we've got to really pull it back and use the subtlest, simplest take. But on set, the only thing that sort of crucifies me as an actor is if someone comes in with judgment or a preconceived notion.
Uh-huh.
Because it's just limiting. And that's why it's so fun to work with actors who come in with that sensibility. They're super inspiring. Sean Penn's a great example because I told him this once, that he's my favorite actor I've ever worked with for off camera. This dude is off camera and he's there 8,000,000% even more. He just wants to try everything he can for you and it's a very selfless experience to witness. And he just wants to give so much for you to, not just to do your best or be good, but for you to explore all the options. And that's, you know, that's super fun to work with people like that.
Do you remember the time you made that realization about a non-judgmental look at a character? Like, do you remember, did someone teach you that? Or do you remember when that kind of dawned on you?
With writer directors, I've known it because they wrote a character that is so flawed. But I think the first obvious time I was in awe of a director was on Recount. Jay Roach was directing, who's the nicest man anyone will ever meet, and a beloved friend. And he looked at me, and I was sort of, we were talking about starting shooting. We hadn't started. And I was sort of laughing about the idea of something. I was playing Secretary of State Catherine Harris, and obviously it's a real story and real people, and it's complicated, and everyone has an opinion. And Jay said, yeah, she's my muse. She's my muse. And that just stunned me. And I realized that I was in more judgment than he was.
Wow.
And he was in awe of her ability, no matter what anybody thought of her, to truly be who she was. And obviously not care what people thought of the way she handled herself or the way she looked or her amount of makeup or the choices she made in Florida during that election. You know, she did what she needed to do, and she was going to make sure that George Bush was our next president. And that was her mission. And so he found a place to admire her, and that really inspired me. The other person, Jonathan Demme, came on to Enlightened and was so in love with my character, Amy. And, you know, he saw her belief in the greater good of man, and he let everything else disappear. So every time I would get locked into all the other things I was supposed to do, because there was a lot to do in, you know, a very short time, he would always bring me back to her mission. And when he would, I think it made everything work and everything funny and everything, and Mike's beautiful poetic writing come alive, because it came from the true place of, I will not stop at anything. If I have to kill people, I'm going to make this world a better place. Which is, you know, and that's how we saw her, which really taught me a lot about Amy. So I think that in the last, you know, 5 years of meeting directors who have that level of passion and compassion for a character has really turned me on to have a deeper commitment toward the people I play.
Right. Well, in the case of Enlightened, you surprised me so much in that series, because what I realized with the arc of that story and with your character was that in the beginning, as a viewer, I found my petty self being able to look at all the things that I could judge about her, ingratiating behavior, the sense of how maybe dependent she was on other people's liking her, and all these things that really pale in comparison to what her heart was. And I found that, in a way, and I don't even know if this was Mike or your intention from the beginning, but she becomes such a likable hero by the end of the film that those other things, you end up turning around and judging the other characters on the show for not being able to see her heart once you as a viewer see her heart. And I think that's you. I think that you were able to infuse her with that thing, like just that right balance of, you made us see ourselves in her or something. Oh. And I imagine that tone was really hard to get right. I mean, was that something you and Mike discussed from the beginning, or?
Well, we did, although, you know, I first of all, it's so beautiful how you described it. So it would be our great wish that anyone would feel that. So that's such a tribute to the show and to the characters. So I'm so grateful to hear you say that. And even though it's a wish, and even though it's a wish for me to, you know, strategize you know, how to explore this incremental growth of a character. There's nothing without the poetry of Mike's writing and his probably conscious and unconscious commitment, an instinctual commitment to, you know, allowing people in through the course of these two seasons.
Right.
You know, his strategy is clear in who she was going to become. But I think in some way he did make a commitment, just as you described, to make sure people come along for the ride.
Right.
And, you know, we, perhaps like any true collaboration that's worth its salt sometimes you're always like-minded and you always see the same vision. But I think for Mike and I, and hopefully in years to come, we will realize this more and more, we had hard moments because we were both fiercely protective of Amy. And sometimes, you know, we would battle each other on how to get to what you described, because I think we both had to protect our visions. And ultimately it was the same vision, but we both had to get there at different times in different ways, and
right.
be wrong or right at different times in different ways. And it was quite a journey, because, you know, a lot of people don't find rage or ego or narcissism or determined commitment to changing others, any of those qualities, pretty. And certainly the one you described, which is needing to be liked while mm-hmm. doing all of it. So, and I am very committed to being it. Truthfully, that is really important to me. And if I feel I'm not, I have disdain for my own craft. Like, it bums me out if I'm not going there all the way. And it's funny, for a girl who really does like to be liked in my life, I'm super comfortable with not being liked in my characters. So one day I'll hopefully balance it out. So it was a really interesting journey, I think, for Mike and I both. And he, you know, was very determined to let that flower unfold.
Well, I would think in films you could be someone else and get through your 12 weeks or your 16 weeks or your 8 weeks or whatever. But I think, you know, you've never done a multiple season television arc as the lead role. And I would imagine that it would be hard to not let yourself and what's going on in your own life and the time that passes slip into that character, right? It's as this character grows, you're going to infuse it with your real life. You just couldn't help it. Did you find that to be the case?
You know, good news, bad news. The bad news is I'll probably find out in like a decade how it did infuse my personal life. And have to be accountable for that. Right now, I'm just completely unconscious about how it affected my life. And in terms of in the workplace, you know, when I'm on set, I'm pretty good at leaving it at work. But when I'm on set and my character is feeling everything in an enormous way, and that's her main characteristic, so I have to sob hysterically at the drop of a hat or rage violently at the drop of a hat, and I'm like in the middle of a scene and I'm an executive producer and HBO or Mike or anyone on set has an opinion that is against Amy, oh no, that's not probably going to be a good moment, and I probably won't handle it the way Laura might handle it.
Right.
So I, you know, in retrospect, I'm sure I was very triggered far more easily while doing that in the workplace than anything I've ever done. To keep it alive all the time.
And the fact that your mom in the show is your mom in real life. which further blurs the line, I suppose, between life and art. And I think of one scene especially, which is when you're in the bedroom and you come back, and I think Dermot Mulroney's character has just said, you know, like he's gotten what he needed. And
yeah.
He kind of kicks you to the curb, and you're back in the bedroom, and you kind of break down.
Yeah.
And it shocks your mom, because not only she hasn't seen the side of you maybe as much, but also her character is such a so afraid of intimacy and so just needs to control. And the way your mom decided to hug you was such an amazing choice, like grabbing you by the shoulders, almost like a cross between a hug and don't do this, you
yeah.
know? But I watched that and I thought, well, you know, what's going on in your head at that point as you're crying in a very amazingly real emotional way and your mom is behind you? I mean, that had to be a hard day. I can't just be acting. Or am I totally wrong? And
no, my God, you're totally right. And on a TV series, unlike the feature version, on that schedule, that was at the end of a day where Luke Wilson and I had already done 6 pages. So it's just the physical marathon of doing that much content was already different for me. I mean, in small independent film, we know you are working pretty crazy hours too and doing a lot of pages, especially these days.
Sure.
Because we've got like 24 days to make a movie or something. So, you know, in some ways I'm used to it, but it's a lot, you know, Amy just is so emotional all the time that it's there is stamina involved. And so the relief is that you come to that scene and it's your real mom. And the overwhelming emotion inherent to that is that there is a naturalness to it. You know, you're not gonna lie with your mother. And I mean, she's such a brilliant actor, so obviously she's so inspiring too. But also, back to the thing of not being judged, we had the extraordinary offering of Todd Haynes directing that episode and that scene.
Gosh.
And Todd never judged me. And I think I kind of had to have a panic attack in order to really be honest about it. And so I needed to take some time emotionally. Todd got the camera ready, made sure everything was quiet, knew to give it to me, which is delicious. And when I came in on the first take, I kind of had a panic attack, which I've not really had, and certainly not on a set. And I'm sure it was too much, because it was almost violent, and I couldn't catch my breath, and it was very emotional. And perhaps it was too much for the you know, the few moments that scene had. Perhaps it would be overwhelming. But there was no way, you had to start there, or I had
go
to start
farther.
There to get to the perfect place. And Todd, you know, so lovingly, you know, just let me stay in that space, kept the camera rolling, knew how to guide mom, how she should come sort of from behind, how to orchestrate it, and kept me in this space with so much love, like, this is perfect what you're doing. As opposed to, whoa, you know, if somebody comes in
right.
and goes, oh my God, that's way too much. You're not thinking about doing that, are you? You know, I mean, suddenly everything's
yeah,
gone and
yeah.
you're starting over. It's like he knew I was in the zone and had to find it. And he also knew the exact number of takes to get what he felt was necessary to tell the story. And some directors go, well, that's cool. Maybe we'll get something 8 more takes down the road. And then you're just emotionally so fried.
Sure.
That it becomes like you're chasing something. So it's really, it's such a gift for an actor to be guided by somebody who really knows where to land in terms of protecting you and the number of takes you need. So he was such a partner to mom and I. And she's just amazing. And, I, you know, obviously she's a brilliant actor. And with me or with my dad or with anyone close to her or a stranger, she will be brilliant. But to be a rather overprotective, enormously affectionate, engulfing mother, if anything, throughout my life, to have played this role with such immense restraint is such a triumph to me with your actual daughter.
Yeah.
So every instinct she might have as a mother, she had to counter it for Helen. And I was amazed by her.
Yeah, and I'm sure at that point when you're just engulfed in tears, even though she's acting, something in her mind is going, well, what is she drawing from? What is, you know,
yeah.
what's going on there? And
yeah.
do we need to talk after the day's over or something,
yeah.
you know? 'Cause I imagine that's just... to be able to go there and do this thing. Like, it must be such, for a mother, such a conflicting set of emotions.
Yeah.
Of, you know, where's she going? How do I help her? What's, you know, it really made me think, you know, what was going on behind the scenes there between the two of you?
I've got to say, I feel so blessed. I mean, we had the experience a few times, and it was in my early 20s, but, you know, to be 40 years old working with your mom, and now you're a mom, and my kids would come and watch the two of us work together. It was incredible. It was just incredible. And I went and visited the set of Nebraska, this movie you and mm-hmm. I were talking about that my dad did with Alexander. And, you know, to bear witness to my parents now, it's just such a different experience. And my level of understanding of them, you know, what I need, the list is far less than what it was then. My expectations are so different. I pray I get to work with my dad. 'Cause it's an incredible opportunity in life to have that.
Yeah. I wonder if your parents ever had any second thoughts about you working at such a young age, and if you've ever talked to your mom about that, or if it was just such an overwhelmingly positive thing.
Listen, man, my mom, I don't get it. She is the most overprotective mother there is. And yet she let me do this. And she says, well, you know, I had no choice. And then she'll say, you know, I'm working on this film and there's a part for an 8-year-old girl. Jaya would be perfect. I'm like, I am never letting Jaya act at 8 years old. Oh, Laura, you can't stop her. Might be her destiny.
You're like doing her perfectly well.
I've had a lot of years. But I mean, is she insane? No, Jaya's not acting at 8. And I don't think people should act at 11.
What is that reaction? Is it times have changed, or is it that you particularly feel like you were this strong-willed person that you were going to do it regardless?
Times have changed. I mean, I was 11 and wanted to be an actor in a movie. I didn't want to be a pop star on the cover of a magazine with my own YouTube video at 8. Times have changed. I didn't want my own Disney show. I didn't want to, you know, dress like a whore at 7. I'm sorry. Let's just break it down. I mean, just the posters alone out of all the magazines that our little girls are looking at. It's like having my own reality show. Like, there wasn't even a reality show. Having, right. you know, and actors were on the cover of American Film, maybe. There was no Entertainment Weekly, let alone People Magazine.
You wanted to study a craft.
Yeah.
You're saying kids today want to be stars.
Instantaneous celebrity, you know.
Right, right.
And their models are Justin Bieber, you know. Their models are pop insanity. And you know, like, it's like you do that and then you also become an actor or an actress, or you're the voice in a Disney movie.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very different concept of celebrity. And by the way, not that that means that they aren't actors and want to be actors genuinely, but I think the one great thing is that, you know, I was forced to study for a few years before I did it. Then, you know, it was the 70s. My parents never questioned anything. I mean, other than my grandmother, the only babysitter in my life was Z Channel. And they were like, oh, Z's on, you know, something's starting at 7. Why don't you watch that? We're all having dinner outside. Me and my friends are out. And it was, you know, this really cool movie.
Eraserhead.
Well, if I was lucky, it wasn't Eraserhead. It was a little movie by Kubrick.
Did you see The Shining?
Clockwork Orange.
Oh, Clockwork Orange.
I saw that at 11.
That must have freaked you out.
Dude. I mean, I remember seeing The Omen at 10 because it was on Z. You know, all the nominated films were on Z and you just watch all the movies. So I saw everything. Paul Thomas Anderson, who also grew up in the Valley, we went to high school together for a moment in time too. And we talked about, you know, what we saw on cable television. And we saw everything.
Yeah.
And it was just all there for the taking for all of us. And, you know, so definitely times have changed. More protective of children and far less protective of children now. So, you know, I hope my kids have a delicious childhood filled with plenty of time to figure out what truly is their calling. But in the case of my kids, you know, they have a musician father who both of his parents were musicians, and, you know, me with two actor parents. So it's not like they have a lot of diversity. We'll see what they do with it.
It's interesting when a kid has that many examples in the arts and how just different opportunities open up. And maybe that conversation never takes place of, you know, what's your plan B? Like, did you ever have that conversation of, well, what if this acting thing doesn't work out? Or was it just, you know, was it moving all too fast to ever think about?
I mean, I never had it with my parents, which speaks to their, you know, that they were coming from their experience, which is, it's all I want to do, know how to do, will do. So there was no conversation. But I went to a college preparatory school in Los Angeles that was very academically minded and very focused on going to an Ivy League college. So I definitely had those conversations with teachers and within my own mind. And when I was going to go to school, chose a major, a double major that had nothing to do with film. And
What did you choose?
Journalism and psychology. And, you know, I was interested in writing and I was very interested in the idea of working with children somehow. So I think I always had in my mind, you know, maybe this is a thing I'll love in my youth and not want to do as a grown up. But I went to UCLA for 2 days and left to go do Blue Velvet. And then they wouldn't let me take a leave of absence, so then I went to SC, and I did a semester and a half at SC, and then got another film, and they were like, what are you doing? You want to go work. And they were such important movies at the time that I was doing them. You know, I felt like I made the right choice, even though I was sad to leave. And then at 29, I went back to school to Loyola Marymount.
Oh, you did?
Yeah, for a year. Which I loved while acting, but it was just hard, but I loved it. I studied world religions and psychology. I love the idea of going to school. I just have never stopped to do it for the whole deal.
Well, but I think that in some ways you have been going to school the whole time. One of the things I find amazing about being around people who are in the arts is that one thing always leads to another, to another, to another, and oh, it's this book you have to read, and in this book there's this character. Well, that character was based on something in the Bible, and you know, and if you just stay interested, you know, as a photographer, school was probably, you know, it was probably 3.5 years too long, because once you figure out how to do it, all you want to do is do it.
Right.
So if you think about going to film school and having a guest director series, if the list of directors you worked with came in.
Yeah.
And you had those people, you know, from a very young age, you know, and their whole investment in you was like an education to me. I mean, I think it's the most incredible opportunity in the world.
It's incredible. The only challenge is I will be absolutely clear that I am not capable of helping, for sure, my son with his math beyond a fourth grade level. I'm definitely at basic math. And he said to me the other day, what do you use math for? He's like, I mean, I'm just not into it. Like, what do you really use it for? I was like, Ellery, math is essential in your life. You really need to focus on it. Okay, how do you use it as an actor? I was like, you know, when we're at a restaurant
We have to calculate the tip. You really have to know those percentages, especially around 15, 20.
And I know how, I mean, I can look at that bill and I know just how to figure that out. And I'm so proud of it.
Well, you talked earlier about, you know, the choices you make, and not only in the films you do, but what you're saying. And it's true. When you come along into a place where, you know, you've been in one of the biggest blockbusters of all time, and it gives you this incredible opportunity to have a voice, and what you do with that really says something about you as a person. When you go out to do publicity on a film, do you look at that as an opportunity?
Huge.
You do.
I mean, not every time, and not with every film specifically. Uh-huh. I mean, I do look at every moment as an opportunity. You know, whether we're sitting on the floor with our kids or we're doing an interview, everything's an opportunity to connect and communicate. So that interests me the most. And to try to be as present and honest as I can be in those moments interests me. I never want anything to feel false or not be another moment to hopefully be even more truthful. That's the fun of it. And you've gotta have fun, because a press junket ain't no fun. I mean, it's like so exhausting. You can't believe how a press junket would be more exhausting than any movie anyone could do. But, you know, you're sitting like this and every 4 minutes someone else is coming in with the sure. same exact three questions. So to really try to be authentic and have fun with it, you know, I think is fair and interesting. And you're being a salesman, and we're all salesmen of our work, of our wares. So I try to be the best, you know, Tupperware salesman I can.
Right.
But when you add to it, you know, that you're 6 or 7 weeks out from people voting for the next president of the United States, and it's Barack Obama versus John McCain, and you have a film like Recount that's speaking about making sure that your real vote actually counts, that's an incredible platform.
It strikes me, just hearing you talk like that too, that you are somebody that you seem to, like you said, I look at every moment as an opportunity. And I was speaking with Judd Apatow on this show, and he said that the actors that really are going to have long-term success are the ones that make their own opportunities. And I think that was the case with Enlightened, obviously. You decided to go out and make something. Did that model kind of open your eyes up to how to move forward in the future with projects?
You know, partially. It's, I'm not a mogul type, you know, so I don't just seize opportunity. It has to hit me. That's the only challenge with it. I wish I was someone who went, oh, great, let me make 20 things. I have a fierce advocate in my life for that, which is Jamie Lemons, who you met, who was a producer on Enlightened, was my assistant for many years, and has always encouraged me in wanting to produce things together to find material that we love. Because I'm not someone who's passionate about producing. Uh-huh. I'm passionate about creating content that I love. So to really work together to find what those next things are is the fun of it, and to find the right filmmaker or the character that I've never played. But it is an inspiring time for that. It's like I know who I really want to work with, so if they or we can find the way to a piece of material that everybody can love, then you're creating your own party instead of getting invited to one that may or may not be your ideal.
Well, you're in that rare category of people that started young and managed to get through that very awkward stage of becoming an adult and maintaining a career. And now, you know, you've got this body of work that's so large because you started so young. And I'm sure from the beginning, you know, there must have been some kind of sketchy moments, I would think. You know, I think of, you mentioned Smooth Talk, and, you know, you're what, 15 when you
yeah.
were filming that? And there's that scene where Treat Williams is at the door, and you're inside the house, and it's that super long piece of dialogue. And as an actor, Was there an awareness at the time of kind of the different levels of sexuality and behavior and stuff going on, or was it more you were in the director's hands and trying to do what you were told?
I think there were instincts, but not true awareness.
Right.
You know, and I think that was great. It was amazing, actually, to get to explore that at 15 with the filmmakers, because I wasn't a 19-year-old trying to remember back.
Right.
And so what I the quality that I had that I thought was good for the movie was that I was trying on being a woman, but I had no idea what that was.
But that's exactly what the movie was about.
And that's what makes it so terrifying in terms of being in this scene with a predator. And I think why so many people were affected by the movie, because she's exposing herself to this predator and even sexualizing herself by flirting and trying on behavior that she's seen at the mall or seen in the TV show or the movie she's watched. And it's so much more dangerous than if someone was smart enough to start to feel what was safe and not safe, or if she was or wasn't in control of her own sexuality. So that made it super scary for the viewer. For me, I think trying to be pretty, and he was cute, and I was trying to flirt, and I don't think even as an actor I really understood the danger of the scene.
Right.
Because I wasn't thinking of it as sex, I was thinking of it as flirtation, because I didn't know what the end result would be, and it's not written in the script.
No.
So not until probably 10 years later, when Kate Capshaw and Steven Spielberg saw that movie and they were very affected by it, and Kate was the first person who said to me, "My God, when you just like realize that she's gonna be raped." And I was like, "She was?" I didn't clock it because I didn't understand the movie in that way. And that's what's so beautiful about that moment in time, was I really didn't totally get it. But also I was fiercely protected by this first-time director, Joyce Chopra. Mm-hmm. Her husband, Tom Cole, who has since passed but was one of my dearest friends who wrote it, and back to great collaborators, my beloved, who has also since passed, cinematographer, Jim Glennon, who became such a part of my family, was so protective of me, and the way he and Joyce chose to shoot me, I think, inferred a lot that I didn't even understand. The way he chose to shoot my body made me more of a sexual object.
Yes.
Than I was aware of. And he was a brilliant DP and remained friends. I worked with him over the years. He worked with both of my parents over the years. And when Alexander Payne asked me to shoot his first feature, Citizen Ruth, I said, "You have to meet Jim Glennon. I really feel like he's your partner in crime." He loved him, hired him, and since did 3 films with him until Jim passed away. Oh, and Citizen Ruth, I couldn't have done without Jim either. You know, he's just so brilliant and funny and operated himself and made it amazing. So that was an incredible experience. I haven't seen it in years. I'd probably be so freaked out seeing that movie now.
Well, it is, you know, you wonder about how that was explained to you at that age and how much your parents were involved in that, because, you know, when you think about that and The Fabulous Stains and, you know, and then right into Blue Velvet, you're still very young, and, you know, you're actually delivering these very complex sexual messages to the audience.
Yeah.
Without maybe being totally aware of what you're doing.
Yeah.
And it brings up a question for me about Blue Velvet, which is, what was your reaction when you saw the first cut of the film?
It speaks to the fact that I must be far weirder, or have been far weirder than I realize, because I saw it and just thought it was so funny and, you know, disturbing, but nothing seemed to faze me from the script as well. I just thought it was brilliant and Wild at Heart disturbed me a lot more.
More than Blue Velvet?
Yeah.
Because there was no morality to Wild at Heart?
Yeah, perhaps that I was in the middle of it in Wild at Heart, and maybe, you know, with Blue Velvet I was sort of the symbol of light in a way, so mm-hmm. The dark side was far away from me. But I mean, I remember being 17 and David going, okay, you're going to walk into the apartment. I don't want you to go in there until we shoot. So whatever you see, just take it in. And at the end of Blue Velvet, and Jeffrey Beaumont, Kyle MacLachlan's character, and my character walk into Dorothy's apartment, and it's a crime scene. And I just remember walking in my pretty flowered dress, and David plays music live. Love Letters Straight From My Heart is playing. And it's this crazy, brilliant design set by Patty Norris. And I remember looking down and going, oh, my shoes are white, and there's brains on the floor. I guess I should step over those. Are those brains? I wonder whose brains those are. And I realized, like, David is so incredible at setting up a world. If you are a wild innocent, which I was, you're really just in shock.
Well, it shows.
Which I am. I was just like, oh, there's brains. And I don't think even I, Laura, could really get myself wrapped around what was happening. Or even clock, that meant someone had been shot and I was in a crime scene. Like, you know, and I'd read the script, but I think hopefully with some intelligence as an actor, I just let myself be the most innocent part of myself, but I also think it was a truthful part of me at that time. Whereas, you know, at 20 on Wild at Heart, I was, I don't know that I was less innocent, but I was a woman suddenly, and had my own sexuality and was exploring that while making the movie. Like, what does this mean and who am I? You know, now as a woman and in relationship to men and, you know, and the violence was all around me. I mean, even my own mother, playing my mother, was sort of part of the violence in the film. So that was a very different world. It was like, you know, I couldn't get it off me.
That's what I find fascinating about Blue Velvet and Smooth Talk and some of these early films, where you were very sexual and womanly in your body, but still very innocent.
Yeah.
Your face. And I find that that's one of the interesting things about that time in your career was that, and this, to me, informs your characters all the way, is that it's like when someone is just working with their beauty, it's a different, it's only the sexuality that informs the character. With you, it seems like you managed to preserve a little piece of whatever that was before you discovered that, and you seem to be able to take it with you, you know? Like, I see that in the characters you choose as well.
I think when you're playing sexy, it's really uninteresting. It works, you know. It works in a photograph, in Vogue, and it works. I mean, I think it works in a photograph better, but in moving pictures, you have to have so many aspects of self at work. And I think it's what we fall in love with in each other, that we, you know, we want someone's... you know, belief in self and also immense humility. And if both things don't exist, it gets uninteresting super fast.
Yes, I agree.
So, and hopefully sexuality is innocence too. And so I think that's a really good thing to keep alive at any age. You know, there's something beautiful about seeing older women in film, which is why at least I will move to France. But, you know, you can explore sexuality in your 50s and 60s and 70s in film in Europe. And there is something very beautiful about it. To see, you know, a 50-year-old woman shy.
Like Charlotte, you know? Rampling. Or...
Yeah. Or yeah. Even in The Graduate, you know, she's mm-hmm. so controlling. Mm-hmm. But then when she feels him overtake her, and start to become the more powerful one in the room, and maybe she doesn't have ownership of him anymore. There's a demureness in Anne Bancroft that we didn't see at the beginning, and that's something so tender about that. I hope, you know, thanks to the directors I work with, I believe I'll be lucky enough to explore those kinds of things, you know, in an age where if I was just counting on playing for looks, you wouldn't get to explore the emotion in it as much.
I think that's the key to being successful, is always trying to look honestly at the times we're in and what we are going through, and using that as an artist to try to relate.
I've got to say, in addition to the directors and the films we've talked about, people who influence us, you know, the musicians who've made the choice to tell a story with a record has been as influential on me in terms of my choices as an actor as anything in my life as a creative fan. You know, I think so many great bands do that and want to always explore. And the people who are on the road of exploration are the ones that keep us all going to continue to hopefully evolve and try things that scare us and not really consider outcome.
Right. If you look honestly at any band that makes a great record, it's what blew them away and what made them step up their career to the next level. Was there ever a film like that for you where you saw it and you said, I have to be better at what I do?
I think Shelley Winters, when I was very young, seeing both Lolita and Place in the Sun, her willingness to be unpleasant and her being considered in the way to drive the storytelling seemed so selfless to me, because it's what carries the whole movie. And I thought that was so beautiful. And in Lolita, her sexuality comes from a competitiveness and comes from a need, a desperate need to be wanted. And that was somehow also sexy in the film and misunderstood. And so anytime I saw the lines get gray, I remember as a kid, also a teenager, seeing French Lieutenant's Woman, and both Meryl Streep and Jeremy Irons' performances were so disturbing, both because you're going in and out of what you don't know if it's other lifetimes of the same souls or parallel universes. It's a very complicated film to watch. But what I saw was the role that anger played in love. And that was interesting to me. So all of these things in terms of performances made me eager to explore the opposite of what was seemingly there in a scene. That was super fun. And comedies did that for me so much. So many comedies were such great influences on me. Obviously Woody Allen's work, but Paul Mazursky and Robert Altman and people who were, and Hal Ashby certainly, exploring the humor in sad or broken or neurotic places, I think made me inspired to be in what I think are comedies, but, you know, a lot of people think are super dark movies.
Right.
I keep thinking, I've been in comedies my whole life. I mean, in a way, Citizen Ruth's a comedy, Rambling Rose is a comedy, Blue Velvet, Wild at Heart. I mean, they're all comedies in a way.
What is the most important thing that you, or the responsibility that you think you have to a director?
Oh, huge, huge. I take it so seriously, and I think I have a huge responsibility to be, you know, deeply emotionally prepared for the journey. I don't know where it's going to take me, but I work diligently at trying to understand who the character is in relationship to my own journey and limitations, and how the other characters affect that journey. And I've worked since I was 18 years old with an acting coach named Sandra Seacat, and I work very closely with her on most things I do. To just try to open me up to all the possibilities of what my understanding of what the dynamics are at play in these relationships. Because if I understand the dynamics of, you know, hurt and longing and heartbreak and what the potential of growth is for the character, then hopefully when I'm there, all the different things that can happen will. But if I don't understand it, it's going to be trying for something. So I take personal responsibility to try to have a real understanding for all that's possible. And then, you know, it's sort of like life, you know. At one point in our life, we say we're going to be courageous enough to go to therapy and learn everything we know. And we feel so proud of ourselves to have learned where we came from, what the damage was in our childhood, where our parents or their parents or even their parents got it wrong, what the lineage is that we're passing on and how we'd like to do it differently so that our kids can grow even incrementally and do it differently than us.
Sure.
And we walk out of that room so unbelievably thrilled that we figured out what we do every time we get triggered and that person says this thing, and then we go home to our lover and we do it all over again. Huh. That's like the gift of acting. It's like I can understand everything about this so that I can do it really wrong. And that's, you know, wrong meaning human.
Meaning
wrong.
Wrong
meaning, you know, with deep flaw and an attempt at being noble but being totally narcissistic or broken or whatever the character might do with it. Because, you know, like playing Amy was an amazing experience because I didn't really have a preconceived idea of when she was necessarily going to get it totally right.
Right.
Or fail. I knew she was going to try really hard. And sometimes from take to take, I'd fail miserably and be so much in my rage or my contempt for someone, or I'd, you know, be really kind to someone. So, you know, that's the fun, but I knew her.
Well, it seems also that the more you know everything about the character, the more you can throw it away in a scene because it's in you already,
yeah.
Instinctually. Because I would imagine that being able to react to something that was unexpected in the scene while still maintaining the limitations or the boundaries of the character, and that must just come from tremendous experience.
I don't know. I mean, some days I would feel that, and some days I would feel the opposite,
right,
just because it was such a long journey of a couple of years. But, you know, being afraid is fun, too, in a way. You know, it's part of, it's like falling in love, you know. There's fear in it because you don't know the outcome, but you have to hurl yourself into it. You have very little option except not experiencing life. So I feel like that's the first day on most movies. But I like that feeling, you know.
I was very sorry to see that show be canceled, but it did wrap itself up so well that I almost feel like there was either a premonition of that or that Mike and you said all you wanted to say. I mean, did you kind of see it as a two-season arc? Or?
I mean, honestly, I think we always talked about 3 seasons.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that we saw beyond that. And the third, I think, being important to both of us. But I think he also felt that that was an option,
uh-huh.
That we wouldn't get that third season. And I think he wanted it to be wrapped up if that choice was made. And certainly the end of the second season, we always knew she would achieve her goal. We just like the idea of exploring what does someone like that do with it once they're on a platform. So I think we were prepared for it to go both ways.
Right. The scene I thought really gave it nice closure was when Amy sees the story in the newspaper stand in the coffee shop. And there's a moment of your reaction that just says, like, you just know she's going to believe in herself a little bit more. Like,
yeah.
Like something actually worked out and she did it. I thought that was such a great, you don't often get that kind of closure to a character. You know, it's kind of a vindication for her, but also for the audience. And it just speaks to how perfect the tone of that whole show was in terms of, you know, the art direction, the locations that were picked, the long kind of shots spent on just the Rose Garden or the street. It really was the entire world through Amy's eyes. And then when you see her see that newspaper, it's like we had 2 seasons of all that visual information of how she sees.
Yeah.
That's what I thought was so brilliant about that show, is that it really lined up the tonal thing with the character. You know, so I mean, you got to be proud of that.
Oh, so proud. So excited. I mean, yeah. What a luxury.
Yeah. I mean, how do you top that?
I know. I mean, hopefully you don't top, but you just continue to do things inspiring and different, you know, yeah. I have to figure out what's different.
Well, speaking of inspiring, your father got, and his film Nebraska got a 7-minute standing ovation at Cannes.
So awesome.
And he said, I think that this is the role he's been waiting for his whole life. I mean, at his age, how does that make you feel, you know?
I mean, I think he feels so proud, and he said, you know, he just turned 77 last week, so it was literally days from his 77th birthday, and he just spoke to it being such a dream to have wanted something or needed something, and now being in a place where he doesn't want or need, he can be in the humility of it, but just be so grateful and so excited, and as an actor, so fulfilled. And he's so incredible in this movie, and it just makes me so proud and excited for him. I can't wait to see it 10 more times.
To have that at that stage in his career is just, it's like the greatest gift you can have, right?
It's incredible. I mean, it's what we all long for, you know, and we all long for being, you know, for challenging ourselves and bettering ourselves in whatever our craft is as we continue, as opposed to being in your 70s and someone talking about the thing they loved that you did at 23, as well as what I said about Scorsese, to really feel like you've built a body of work. Uh-huh. You know, if I can do that, I would be super excited. And I would be super excited to be 80 and be at a film festival. And if someone were to look back at my career, that there would be clips from age 11 or 16 or 23 or 30 or 50 or 70 that all involve films of value.
Yeah.
That would be my dream. So, you know, I think that was so beautiful for him.
Yeah, yeah, gosh. Well, to have that career, and looks like you're on your way, you know, and I'm sorry we didn't really get to Grizzly 2, which I know is something you really wanted to.
The next interview, I think we should just focus only on that movie.
I think so too.
Yeah. We'll get George Clooney in here.
Yeah.
And he and I can do an hour on Grizzly 2. Actually, there are some stories. They didn't occur on camera, but we were there for 4 weeks waiting to film our scenes. We were like weather cover or something. So it was a hilarious month of my life.
Well, that's something I want to hear more of off camera as well. Really off camera. I could talk to you all day, and it's so fascinating hearing some of this stuff through your eyes throughout your career. And I just thank you for doing this with me.
Thank you, Sam. It's so awesome. I've loved it. And it's, you know, hanging out with family.
Oh, thank you.
So I'm very, very grateful. Well, and I'm happy to come back and talk about Grizzly 2.
Okay, fine. We'll do it again. Okay, we'll do the Grizzly 2 episode.
Okay, good. Okay. Thanks, dude.
Thanks a lot.
You have just finished listening to another episode of Off Camera. To access more episodes, subscribe, and be a part of the entire Off Camera experience, please visit offcamera.com. This has been a presentation of the NTD Broadcast Network.